So we're going to be taking selections tonight from somewhere between chapters 21 and 30, you know, depending on how far we get, and we'll see where we go. So tonight we're going to start with chapter 21, right at the very beginning of it. Do you want to just be my reader? And let's look first of all at this question of serious sin and avoiding it.
My son, if you have sinned, do so no more. And for your past sins, pray to be forgiven. Flee from sin as from a serpent that will bite you if you go near it. Its teeth are lion's teeth, destroying the souls of men. He who hates correction walks the sinner's path. But he who fears the Lord repents in his heart. The path of sinners is smooth stones that end in the depths of the nether world. He who keeps the law controls his impulses.
Okay. Now, there's a lot of little sort of it. There's general advice, and there's a lot of little advice in it. And again, the idea is don't sin. That's the general advice. It says here that to some extent we can atone for past sins by a life of virtue. And I tried to show you this before, this whole notion of reparation. And you hear the word repair and reparation. All right, so if I'm standing here and you say, please take three steps to your right, and I say, I will not, and I take three steps to my left. All right, now I say, will you forgive me? And you say, yes, but I still have to make a journey. Now I have six steps. After I had just done what you told me, I'd only have three steps, but now I have six steps to make. And so part of living a virtuous life to atone or to make up for past sins is, again, just to kind of recover lost ground and not keep going backward again, but keep on a steady path trying to make up and get to where we need to be. Okay? So at least don't continue to lose ground. All right? So now... it says here, notice, and this is a very interesting concept that's kind of lost today. Oh, yes, Pete.
I have a question. So, you know, when you talk about this atonement and walking away and having more steps, so where does this whole thing of, like, in when people say, like, you reap what you sow, in the sense of you're going to get back what you, you know, so if you continue to sin, you're going to get back negative.
Right. Well, again, in the sense of, let's say I took three steps to my left. So in a way, I have to reap what I've sown now. Even though you forgive me, I still have a longer journey to make now, don't I? It's going to be a twice as long as it would have been if I'd just done what I needed to do from the start. So do you see how I'm reaping or I'm harvesting the seeds that I've sown? Okay. It's always a longer journey to sin than it is just to keep the law. All right. It's just always longer. Does that answer your question? Okay. Now, it says here, this word that we often don't hear much of today in terms of sin, but it says flee. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, it says the same thing about fornication. It says flee fornication. See? Flee. Run. Get away from it. We often will hear today, avoid sin, but the Bible says, flee, run from it, okay? So, when you see sin nearby, run. But what happens is, the glamour of evil draws us and we're attracted to it, and so instead of fleeing it, we gravitate toward it, see? And but again, the Bible's advice, again, is to flee. And to have a kind of a salutary fear about sin. Now, what I mean by salutary means saving. A saving fear. Now, we're all aware of types of fear that is not healthy for us, where we're paralyzed and we can't act and so on. But there's also something called a salutary fear or a saving fear. And a saving fear... Well, let's just put it this way. It's a good fear to be afraid to walk near the edge of a cliff, isn't it? Mm-hmm. In other words, you ought to fear that. You shouldn't be near by that. Or to be in the presence of someone or something very dangerous. It's a good thing. You shouldn't say, well, you shouldn't be afraid. Doesn't the Bible say, don't be afraid? And so don't be afraid to walk on the edge of a cliff. But there are some fears that we call saving or salutary or healthy fears. Okay? And having a kind of a healthy fear about sin is that. Now, why should we have a salutary fear of sin? Well, again, because first of all, it can be very powerful, temptation. It can lead us into some pretty serious and dopey decisions, which really can derail our life. So again, we ought to have a kind of a healthy fear about sin. So
could be like caution, like cautionary.
Mm-hmm. Caution could be, but I think the word fear is even stronger, isn't it? It's like saying avoid sin, but the Bible says flee from sin. So I don't want to say that. Caution can be a little less, if you're going to swim in shark-infested waters, just pay attention and be careful. I mean,
yeah.
You just don't go into the shark-infested waters is the better solution, right? So I would say that although caution might be a synonym here, I would also caution that caution might not be a strong enough word here, okay? This is put some definite, quick distance between you and sin if you see it coming. Okay? All right. So flee from sin as from a snake or a serpent, see, that will bite you if you go near it. St. John Vianney has an interesting story or analogy about the devil. He's pondering what kind of fear should we have of the devil. And basically, it's a fear not to go near. We don't have to utterly fear the devil because the Lord has vanquished him, but he's like a dog on a chain. He can't bite you unless you get too close. See? So, in other words, it is true that Satan's power is somewhat restrained, but in the end, if we get too close to him, we can still get bit. Okay? He who hates correction walks in the sinner's path, but he who fears the Lord repents in his heart. So again, the one who fears, or should I say, hates correction walks in the sinner's path. And that's a hard one, isn't it, to be corrected? Especially once we get a little older and we're not as used to it. You know, to be corrected can be a humiliating thing. But in the end, again, it says here that you're walking in a sinner's path. You're headed for trouble. Okay, so somewhere along the line, we have to have the capacity or the willingness to be corrected. To be corrected, he who fears the Lord repents in his heart. Hmm? Now, not everyone who corrects you is perfect, nor are you perfect who correct others. Are you? Right. So again, sometimes what happens when we're corrected, we say, well, how are they telling me this? What about them and their faults? And blah, 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 you know, and that's what we do. And frankly, there may be some real faults that person has. But if you pardon the expression, that is not the issue at hand. Are you familiar with the story of King David? The first book of, second book of Kings. Samuel. David is walking along with his general. I mean, I told you this story before, right? With his general Sisera or whoever. And there's this crazy guy starts throwing rocks at David and cursing him. And so the general says to him, please, King David, allow me to go and lop off his head for speaking to the king in this way. And David said, no, he says, I've committed many sins, and perhaps the Lord sent him to me to humble me and to remind me of my sins. So no, let him go on speaking this way. And in the end, I think sometimes we have to have this attitude that even though sometimes people who correct us are themselves not perfect, and we might immediately in our flesh want to jump to recite all of their faults and all their errors. Oh, come, what about me? What about you? You know, that kind of thing. And sometimes we miss an opportunity from the Lord to really examine that maybe they're correct. And you say, well, how could this be? Well, even a broken clock is right twice a day. Right? So right now that clock is not correct. It says it's 15 to 3. But in not too many hours from now, it'll be correct. Yeah. So, anyway, even a broken clock is right twice a day, right? So, we have to have a lot of humility, so that even when the person who corrects me doesn't seem to be worthy of correcting me, nevertheless, I can still learn. Something important for me to hear from God. Now, remember another story, maybe just to even make this a little bit more plain. You may remember the story of Balaam's donkey. Balaam was told to go the foreign king hired him to go and curse Israel. But every time he tried to curse Israel, he'd open up his mouth and out would come a blessing. So he refused to speak after a while, because every time he tried to open his mouth and curse Israel, out would come a blessing. So he refused to speak. So God spoke through his donkey, and the donkey blessed Israel. Now, if God can even speak through a donkey, maybe he can speak through even a great sinner who might come to me and say, well, you're not so great. See? So, again, this idea, whoever hates correction is walking in the sinner's path. Okay? So, if you hate correction, be careful, because that makes you uncorrectable. The word incorrigible, you know what incorrigible means? To be uncorrectable, right? All right, so you don't want to be incorrigible. All right. Well, why don't we move on to this letter B there, the foolish mind.
A fool's mind is like a broken jar. No knowledge at all can it hold. When an intelligent man hears words of wisdom, he approves them and adds to them. The wanton hears them with scorn and casts them behind his back. Like a house in ruins is wisdom to a fool. The stupid man knows it only as inscrutable words. Like fetters on the legs is learning to a fool, like a manacle on his right hand.
Okay. The fool. Don't play the fool now. But in the Bible, you know, the word fool is a very strong word. Fool is someone who has very little intrinsic worth. All they do is they live for the moment, centered basically on themselves and their own desires, their own passions. They care not for knowledge or God or the things of God. The Bible has very little time for a fool. All right, they're focused primarily on themselves, on what pleases them, what entertains them, and anything that's refined or outside of them or a little challenging, they just can't deal with it. And so the Bible simply refers to individuals such as this as fools. Fools. Now, Jesus cautions in the New Testament not to call someone "you fool," all right? Not to rush to this conclusion, in other words, that someone is simply a fool. We tend to use the word fool today in a lesser, I don't think we mean it quite as, it's not quite as devastating in modern English to just call someone a fool. I mean, we might even just, you know, remember the old Mr. T? I pity the fool. You know, sometimes, again, you know, I don't think it's quite as ugly a term as it is in the Bible. It's certainly not a pleasant term. But again, the idea of a fool is someone who basically is just, they're dopey, they misbehave, and so on. But in the Scriptures, a fool is really someone who is simply not open to the transcendent or anything beyond what can gratify their immediate passions or pleasures, what simply makes sense to their rather tiny little world centered primarily on food and sex and other pleasures. All right? This is a fool. A fool is not open to God, is not open to higher learning, is simply not open to the transcendent. They simply live in a material world. A material girl in a material world. our friend Madonna there. Huh? Material girl. So they live fundamentally in a material, closed-in world. All right, so that's just to remind you, because we talked about this concept of fool early in the course. Now, a fool's mind is like a broken jar. It can't hold any knowledge. Why? Well, again, if it doesn't titillate and cause some form of pleasure, it's just you know, well, you remember the expression, you know, be careful not to cast your pearls before swine. Jesus uses this example of foolish people. Why? Because, well, you know, to us, pearls are very valuable things, right? But a pig only values what it can eat, right? So if a pearl is not very tasty or edible, right? And so what does it do? It doesn't. It just tramples it underfoot. It sees no value in a pearl because it can't eat it. See, and this is the concept. Also a fool, namely that the fool doesn't value anything that doesn't gratify their immediate materialistic needs. Will it make me wealthy? I don't care about it. Will it give me sexual pleasure? I don't care about it. In other words, if it doesn't do these things, if it doesn't meet some basic and very base and very materialistic and very focused criteria, then it's of no value. No value at all. Okay? All right. Now, the fool's mind is like a broken jar. No knowledge can it hold. It just goes in one ear and out the other, anything of real value. When an intelligent man hears words of wisdom, he approves them and strokes his chin. It doesn't say that there, no. But strokes his chin and adds to them. He's thoughtful. When wisdom is being exchanged or shared, there's a certain openness, a delight in it. A thoughtfulness that causes the man to say, I comprehend this, and it occurs to me that this is also so. So, in other words, this is what a wise person does. Now, you know, many of you have been in the position of being a teacher or in some kind of a situation where you might have said to a group, any questions? And no hands go up. And you say, now that means one of two things. Either I was completely clear, there's absolutely no questions here, or they don't get it. All right. So, again, when an intelligent man hears words of wisdom, he approves them, and he adds to them. Okay. Again, the idea of being thoughtful. The wanton, the wanton person, what does it mean to be wanton? No, it's the opposite, really. I mean, to be wanton means all you want is just junk and just junky stuff, and just you don't want anything high or refined. You just live to the base desires, the physical base desires. There's just no, nothing refined in you. It's all about base physical pleasures. Now, by the way, physical pleasures aren't evil or bad, but when I say base, I simply mean that look, they're really the crudest of our desires. All right. Now, we all need desires for hunger, for sex, for drink, for, you know, we need these things or we'd never survive. So I'm not saying they're intrinsically evil or bad, but when I say they're base, I mean they're really the lowest of the desires. We have them in common with animals, and animals have these same desires. There is something base about them. But the higher things, for beauty, for love, for truth, for wisdom, for poetry, art, beauty, and truth, and goodness, and so on. These are the higher, more refined desires. But a wanton person only cares about the base desires. That's all they care about. Okay. Can I eat it? No. Well, I'm not interested. So you see. All right. Now, it goes on to say there, the wanton therefore hears these words with scorn and casts them behind his back. What a waste of time! Who's on the Redskins? Who's the Redskins playing this week or whatever? You know, they don't care about anything beyond, you know, just crude entertainment. Okay, all right. Like a house in ruins is wisdom to a fool. All right. So instead of seeing something beautiful, the fool sees wisdom as just something incoherent and you know, gross. Right. Imagine two people. In a museum of fine arts. Now, there's two individuals here. One is what we would call a base or a wanton man, and another is, you know, has studied a lot about art and really appreciates. You know, when you look at a work of art, it helps to know a little bit about the history of the artist who painted it. It helps to know a little bit about the subject matter. maybe the period of time in which the work was done, what was going on in the world at that time. One would want to know a little bit about technique, shadow, and light, the play between light and darkness, or shadow and light in a painting, the type of color or pigment, and so on. Now, this takes a little bit of study, maturity. It takes a little bit of effort. The Watson man looks at the painting and says, "Well, whatever." But the wise or the refined one will find great delight in the painting because they're equipped to appreciate. So what this text is saying is that to a fool, wisdom is just like a boarded up house, a house in ruins. What a boring old painting. You know, come on, man, doesn't it move or do something? You know, it's not a video game. You know, or something like that. He's just bored with it. Whereas a refined person who has, you know, taken time really appreciates the beauty of something. Now, I don't mean to say that, you know, we don't want to go to the other extreme and then, you know, be just total snobs either, you know. Every now and then, I frankly don't find most modern art to be art at all, frankly. If I could do it, it's not art. You know, splatter paintings and things, you know. So, but I think sometimes you can be in such rarefied air that very few people can join you up there, and in that case you sort of ascend it to the heights of not, you know, truth and beauty, but maybe just arrogance. So we got to be careful here when using this example. But it's the same with music and other things. You know, some people only like the music with a beat they can tap their toe. You know, and other people appreciate there's something beyond just beat, boom, 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 banging on a drum. There's a little bit more to music. You know, they appreciate the sound of a viola, or they appreciate the technique involved in very fine guitar playing, or, you know, something to that effect. So, in other words, but it takes time sometimes to acquire these things. But to someone who has no appreciation for these things, classical music, you've got to be kidding. Please turn that off, you know. And it just bothers them. You know, it's so boring, I want to sleep, you know. Whereas, again, and so that's the idea here, that to a fool, wisdom can appear to be a bore, or boarded up old house, or some ugly thing. But to those who are trained in its ways, there's a beauty to wisdom. All right. Now, I'm not here suggesting, I'm just using analogy, remember? I'm not saying that everybody who hates classical music is a fool. I didn't say that. I'm just kind of using an analogy. All right. So it doesn't mean if you don't like classical, you're a fool. I didn't say that. I'm just saying, just like someone who doesn't appreciate classical music because they haven't studied it or whatever might not see it as beautiful, so it is with a fool who doesn't appreciate wisdom and doesn't see it as beautiful either. Okay? All right. So, with that in mind, it says here, like a house in ruins, wisdom to a fool. The stupid man knows it only as an inscrutable word. Now, inscrutable just means you don't know what? What did you say? Huh? I mean, it sounds like gibberish. Now, I'll grant you, some academicians can get into these discussions where I think they're just trying to confuse. You know, they use this lingo that the average person has no access to. And rather than really trying to teach, they're just demonstrating their own sort of how smart they are, you know. The subconjunctive orbitals of mistophytic morigenes establishes a euphoria yet unknown to the general cross-section of the permitted society. What? You know. So, in other words, I remember Fulton Sheen always told a story. He said when he was a young professor in Rome, he was teaching philosophy and actually theology, and he was teaching on theandric action. And he said, I went on and on. And theandric action is when Jesus, you know, is both God and man. And there are some things that he does that truly incorporate both his divinity and his humanity. For example, when he uses his spittle to make paste and smear it on the man's eyes and clear his blindness. Well, as God, he's curing the blindness, but he's using literally his body to do it. So this is what is meant by theatric action. Anyway, Fulton Sheen was going on and on about this thing, and he said, I was so erudite that day that I confused myself. I didn't, by the end of the lecture, I don't think if a theatric action walked through the door, I would have ever been able to recognize it. I had so parsed and so, and anyway, at the end of the lecture, one of the British students came and said, oh, Dr. Sheen, that was an illuminating lecture. And he said, oh, and Fulton said, what did I say? He says, well, I don't quite know. And Sheen said, I learned that day that sometimes you get credit for being learned when you're simply unintelligible. So again, we want to be careful here that we're not simply saying that this means that the wise or the learned should walk around speaking $10 words just for the sake of impressing people, and that fools are just fools because they can't understand these words. But rather, again, what it's really getting at here, though, is just the entire conversation about wisdom is a boring, inscrutable, stupid thing to someone who's foolish. It just means gibberish to them. They don't care like we care less. Is there any reruns of I Dream of Jeannie on? Can I watch something better than this conversation? Okay. So, but I think I've been teaching some of you in some of our sessions, not here, but in some other groups, you know, that we have to be careful, though, as Christians and Catholics today. Because outside these walls, we use a lot of words inside these walls, that outside these walls, people don't know what they mean. And we go out there talking as though people understand us, and they don't. They don't. Things like Eucharist, even Holy Communion, original sin, you know, even stories that are plain as day to us, stories of Adam and Eve, Noah. You'd be surprised how many particular younger people today don't have any idea. They've heard these words and these names, but they don't really know the stories. You say, well, who doesn't know the story of Adam and Eve? I'm telling you. There are a lot of young people who've grown up on, you know, MTV or hip hop, and they've never read a Bible, and they've never been in a church. And when we come out and start talking about the sin of Adam and Eve, they're like,
"Who is that?
Noah? Now, I've heard that before. What do you know about Noah? Well, not much. You know, I was with a group the other day, I was talking about the sin of David and Bathsheba." And none of the people in that room had any idea what I was talking about. They'd heard of David, Bathsheba, no, and they had no idea about, you know, how David committed adultery with Bathsheba and so on, and killed Uriah. Many of you, I see, are nodding and are familiar with the story. But again, I'm just saying to you that we have to be careful lest we start, you know, sort of walking around in rarefied air and we have absolutely no connection to the world around us any longer. Now, I don't mean we have to dumb it all down, but we have to be very careful that people sometimes, I've used the expression mortal sin, I'm telling you. I was in a group of Catholics, younger Catholics, high school kids. I said, do any of you know what mortal sin means? No one raised their hand. I said, well, come on, at least one of you knows. And someone finally raised their hand. Is that when you kill someone? See? But again, it's just typical. A lot of us who are older Catholics grew up with that concept. We know, but they don't. And we have not handed it on. Another example, it just slipped away.
It's like what my grandmother used to say, you know, you can be so heavenly bound that you're no earthly good.
Yeah,
right. Because people can't understand where you're going. And, you know, sometimes you're making jokes with your Christian friends, and you really don't realize they're like, what are you talking about? You're like, don't be a Jezebel. They're like,
Right.
You know, my middle name's Jezebel.
You're like, right. No, you're right. I mean, and even to a lot of church-going Catholics, being a Jezebel, they've heard this expression, but they don't really know the story of Jezebel or the Book of Revelation or the Old Testament or any of those references. And, you know, it's just pretty esoteric. And unfortunately today, we've gotten so wrapped up in internal squabbles in the churches that we've lost touch with the culture, and they've lost touch with us, and we have to just, you know, start from scratch. And All right. So again, we want to be careful with these texts. You don't want to simply be arrogant, describing everybody as a fool who doesn't appreciate high art or doesn't know who a Jezebel is, or, you know, what a fool. You know, we don't mean it that way. You have to be careful not to become arrogant either. That's my only concern. So again, a fool looks at the wise discussions as just inscrutable. What are they talking about? You know. Where's NASCAR racing on the TV here? Okay. I don't mean to be stereotypical. I don't mean to say. All right. Like fetters on the legs is learning to a fool. Like a manacle. You know, to ask a fool to sit down and actually listen carefully and study something and think their way through something is like putting them in prison. Putting manacles on their legs. They're like, man, I can't stand this. Can I just get up now and stop reading? I can't stand, you know. This is just, you know, that's the idea. So, again, we're talking here about the fool. Now, again, notice at the heart of being a fool is that they are not open to the transcendent. That's the most biblical. Now, again, maybe I may be using a $10 word. What is the transcendent? Well, something that is over or above or beyond my simple physical material experiences. So that we can discuss concepts like justice, mercy, kindness, truth, beauty, God himself. Values like chastity, values like kindness and mercy and truth. These things tend to just transcend ordinary physical material existence. So the word transcend means to go beyond the simple here and now. Okay, and so this is at the heart of being a fool in the scriptures is someone who simply cannot comprehend God or the things of God or concepts like goodness, truth, beauty, justice, and some of the insights of the beauty of the commandments and God's ways, simply because all they care about is, can I eat it? Well, no. Well, I'm not interested. Or, you know, can I drink it? Can I have pleasures from it? You know, no. Well, not immediately. Yep. Oh, well, I'm not interested. See, so. All right. Now, there is here another call to be discreet in our speech. Would you like to read that, Pete?
A fool raises his voice in laughter, but the prudent man at the most smiles gently. Fool's thoughts are in their mouths. Wise men's words are in their hearts.
Okay. Now, again, we got to be careful of being stereotypical. I'm like you. I like to have a good belly laugh every now and then, and but we also know people who just goof off. They just goof their way off through life. They just don't. They're not serious about anything. All they want is to have another laugh and goof off and just carry on. And it's all one big joke, you know. And that's kind of what this is getting at, you know. Always just looking for laughter. But there's a time to be serious. And there's a time to be careful not to laugh easily. Because some of the things that some people laugh at aren't really, shouldn't be laughed at. Mm-hmm. One should be a little more thoughtful and serious. And, I'm thinking particularly of some humor which is bigoted or shows a lack of understanding or appreciation for maybe some aspect of other people's lives, you know. Now, on the other hand, I don't want to go the other extreme. I'm afraid that we're too uptight about everything today. You know what I'm saying? Nobody can laugh about anything anymore. It's like, I'm offended. Well, you are. I didn't give offense. I'm sorry that you are offended. I didn't give offense, but, you know. But, I mean, you know, we're a little bit maybe to the extreme, but I think we should be careful. I mean, some of the jokes I used to grow up with, can't repeat today, ethnic and racial and other types of jokes that were told back and forth, and it was a different world back when I was in high school. That's you know, some 30 years ago, and it was we told jokes and said things to each other that, frankly, you just don't do that today. And some of the stuff, and I won't repeat any of it.
Even outside of jokes, I think it's also like outside of jokes, you know, like, you know, a political stand that you may take based on your belief system is just like, if it's outside of what's popular, then
yeah. Yeah,
yeah, it's a very argumentative.
Sure. Yeah, you really want to find me want to hear so much.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I'll just tell you though, it was all in good fun, and I don't think any of it would ever really meant to be hurtful. Let me just say, I used to run track when I was in high school. That was 100 pounds ago, and it was I ran the mile and we used to just joan on each other terribly. Now, let me just be very generalized about this. I don't want to give any examples because it's just not appropriate today. But, you know, I was a long distance. I ran the mile and the 2 mile. I ran the mile relay and different, the 4 mile relay we used to have. Anyway, we used to, we tended to sort each other out in the track group between the sprinters and the field. Some of them, you know, threw a discus or a shot put, the field guys, and the sprinters, the distance and the middle distance runners. And, well, let's just say most of the sprinters were African American, and most of the long distance runners were white, and there was a lot of going back and forth. And it was everything from about physical traits to, you know, different things. And it was back in there. They gave it back just as heavy to us, you know, about, you know, white men, you know, white boys can't do this, you know, white boys that. And, you know, anyway, but it was just kind of the stuff you just don't do today, you know. And in those days, you know, we just did. And I remember the horrible Pollock jokes we used to tell about 30 years, 40 years ago. Pollock, how many Pollocks does it take to screw in a light bulb, you know? Well, that kind of, you know, just awful stuff, you know. I mean, anyway, good old Archie Bunker. All right. So I'm just saying, we have to be careful. Sometimes we laugh too quickly at sometimes the misfortunes of other people. We laugh too quickly at jokes that are inappropriate. And again, a wise person will say, well, at best, this deserved a little, not a huge belly laugh, and let me try to top that one. Boy, you think that's a good Pollock joke? Let me tell you this one. You know, sometimes a wise person will say, "Well, we haven't really gone in a good direction here, so we'll not contribute to this by belly laughing and goofing off and hoisting another brew." All right, so it says here, fools' thoughts are in their mouths. Wise men's words are in their heart. You know, have you ever known someone who, if it's in their head, it's on their tongue? No matter what goes through their mind, they're going to say it?
Right.
Wow, you know, and I'm just, some of the most, well, I won't mention any names, but in my life, I've known a few people who are like this, and I'm like, it is really just shocking and horrifying, some of the things they just, you know, just say in passing. You know, yeah, they just do. And again, to be discreet, to be careful about what I'm about to say going to edify, help, encourage, maybe correct. Occasionally, I need to speak in a negative way about something. But is what I'm about to do, you know, helpful to the individual or the group or the human family that I'm addressing? So these are things, you know, we have to be careful about. And so I don't know what it is how the brain works, because it's interesting, isn't it? Sometimes you can be saying something even before you're thinking it. Isn't that weird? I mean, you just, all of a sudden you're talking, say, is that stuff coming out of my mouth right now? Am I really saying that? And it's a strange, it's almost as though there's a part of the brain that connects to the mouth before it goes into the higher part of the brain. It's kind of a weird thing. Yeah. Right. So again, fools' thoughts are in their mouth. And whatever comes in their mind, they're going to just say it out loud. Burn it out. Oh, you know, that's an ugly hat. I hate it, you know. What the flea market did you get that thing from? Just anything that occurs to them, they just say it out loud. And, you know, that's again, the Bible speaks of this as fools, what fools do. All right, so again, careful with speech. All right, now moving into chapter 22, we need to talk about unruly children, and we're going to pick that up again if we get to it on the next page as well, on the back page. But let's just take a little sampling here.
An unruly child is a disgrace to his father. If it be a daughter, she brings him to poverty. A thoughtful daughter becomes a treasure to her husband. A shameless one is her father's grief. A hussy shames her father and her husband, but both she is despised.
What's the Greek word for that?
I don't know. But, you know, I mean, you know, I suppose we've all heard the word hussy, and we've even used it. We don't always exactly know what it means. Basically, my definition of a hussy would be someone who is lewd in her and sexually suggestive and in a very inappropriate way in her behavior and her posture and the way she dresses. Hussy. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm.
Is what I mean by hussy. Okay. Don't know what the Greek or the Hebrew words underlying that are. by the way, does anyone have something other than the New American Bible open at this point? Just to see if there's other translations other than hussy. Yeah. It would be, by the way, Sirach 22 and verse 5. I'll let you look that up. I'll talk a little bit about this. First of all, an unruly child is a disgrace to his father. Again, my father used to often do this for me. He would remind me, you know, that if I went out of the house and behaved poorly, that I would reflect poorly on the Pope name and the Pope family, and he wouldn't stand for it. Okay. There's an old expression that I remember that was very common. When a child was misbehaving, you know, someone would go, tisk, 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 you know, some people's children. Yeah. And I think there's a little bit less of that today than there used to be. A lot of people don't always think of the parents when the child is misbehaving. And I think mainly because so many children are having trouble with behavior today, and even in very, very good families, there's some pretty difficult and painful stuff that's coming out with kids, and there's so many damaging influences on kids today that we don't always do the math and say, well, this is a bad reflection on the parents. We do to some extent, but I think that there's more of a sense today that there's lots of influences on children, and that you're kind of lucky as a parent if your kids don't succumb to at least some of the bad stuff. So, but anyway, I still think that the teaching here is important. My father would often again try to say to me, "Son, you may go out here and behave and not care what other people think of you, but I want you to think of what they're going to think of me when you behave like that." See? And it kind of gave me an additional motive to, you know, improve my behavior. Does that translation say something different?
A little bit stronger. It says, a shameless daughter brings disgrace on her father as well as her husband, and both hate her.
Oh, okay. But they call it, they say they're shameless. The word they're translating would as a hussy. Okay.
Hate's pretty strong.
Yeah. Right.
Another translation. Impudent.
Impudent.
Impudent. I-M-P-U-D-E-N-T.
Mm-hmm.
Impudent daughter.
Oh. Pudo, pudore in Latin. Impudo, impudore. Yeah, impure, basically. Yeah, okay.
And it's an unruly children. In fact, the fellow at 15th and Mass in Independence today.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or I ran across them one other morning. They're about 13, 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
All have black jackets, black little skull caps, and black jeans.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
From a gang, maybe? Yeah. We're going to talk a little bit more about children in the next page here, so let's, we'll move on to this pretty quickly here. But notice here, I do want to say one cultural thing that's significant in this passage, that if it be a daughter, in other words, an unruly daughter, she brings her father to poverty. Do you see the connection there or not? Probably not. You do?
Well, because a daughter, you know, was supposed to get married,
mm-hmm.
and so the you know, you marry a good person's son, so usually that meant that they had some land. So
yeah. Mm-hmm. It simply meant that your daughter was on the dole for the rest mm-hmm. of her life,
right.
Your life. Mm-hmm. In other words, it could mean that she didn't get to marry a wealthy young man, but not everybody could marry a wealthy young man. But what it really means is that, generally speaking, it was the expectation of a father that he would at some point, when she was about 14 or 15, marry off his daughter, and she was no longer, pardon for me putting it this way, but she was no longer a financial responsibility of his. And you're right, there may have been some additional connections made that actually multiplied the wealth a little, but in the end, she became unmarriageable,
right.
And there were a lot of reasons a young lady could become unmarriageable, because she was had not lost her virginity, or because she was unruly, or just had a bad reputation. Nobody wanted her. There could be a and in that culture at that time, it was almost never a question of looks, because marriages were arranged anyway. But it was just true that there were some families who knew the reputation of certain young women who were just, you know, either, you know, was it hussies, or were just hard to get along with, or brash, or demanding, or petulant. And just nobody would agree to marry his son to her. So, again, and this meant that the family of origin was on the hook, you know, financially for her until, well, basically forever, you know. So this is, I think, the idea here. Now it says here, a thoughtful daughter is a treasure to her husband. So again, it's an exhortation to a man to raise his daughter well so that she'll be a treasure to her husband. See? It's not just for his own sake that a father raises his daughter. Well, remember, this is a Sirach is written by men for men, or by men to younger men. So, but it would certainly include, obviously, a mother would want to raise her daughter well, you know. So, and anyway, it goes on to say here that is a hussy shames her father and her husband, by both she is despised. To some extent, there was a double standard, and there always has been. Less so today, maybe, but that a man might get away with some sexual shenanigans, but a woman just simply couldn't in that culture, and she would be hated and despised by all the women, by all the men, except the ones who used her for a few moments, and then they despised her again. But in the end, it was a pretty tough world for a young lady if she fell through sin in this matter. And it was a very, it wasn't as tough for men. It just wasn't. You remember the story of Jesus and the woman caught in adultery. Now, the Bible says that if a couple is caught in the act of adultery, both of them should be stoned. But you notice at the time of Jesus, they only brought the woman. Now, remember, she was caught in the very act. So we know who the man was. And they only brought the woman. So you see, this is just the nature of the way it was, or should we say the denature of the way it was. But again, we might, I don't think that Sirach here is meaning to say that it's okay for a man to do these things, but it's just a fact in that culture. A woman who is known to be sexually promiscuous was pretty well hated by just about everybody, and except the men who used her, but only temporarily, you know. And they just used them; they didn't really love them, or they thought of them. They would never marry such a woman. They would just use her, and you know. So she had very few real recourses in life, except to maybe become a prostitute or to live on the streets.
I was thinking about how then this makes you really think about how it was like this big deal for like Joseph to get married, knowing that he didn't, you know, didn't get her pregnant.
Yeah. Now there's probably a detail in that story of Joseph that's also good to remember, which most people don't quite catch in the modern age. But it says Joseph, because he was a just man, decided to divorce her quietly. Now notice, he wanted to divorce her. He didn't want anything to do with her. But you notice, and we think, Joseph, because he was a just man, that means Joseph was a nice guy, and Joseph wouldn't have wanted to harm poor Mary, and he really cared for Mary. Well, if he did, then why is he divorcing her? Now, the point is that what he means, when it says Joseph was a just man, it means Joseph was a strict follower of the law. Now, he didn't want to have her stoned, and he didn't absolutely have to have her stoned, but he was going to follow the law. And when you found out that a woman you were marrying was not a virgin, and was certainly with a child by somebody else, you don't know who, you did not bring that kind of a woman into your house. You just did not do it. Because it wasn't just you, it was your whole family that you were disgracing by bringing a woman, quote, a woman like that, you know, into your house. So I don't know if sometimes you know, we've really done the math. I've preached sermons on this at some Christmases in the past. really how difficult it was for Joseph and Mary. They may well have been shunned by their whole family for what they did. You know, Mary by hers and Joseph by his own family. There was certainly a lot of tension. We see in the family a generation later, the so-called brothers of Jesus did not like him at all. And these would have been kin to him, you know, probably cousins. Now, in our Catholic tradition, it wouldn't have been what we call brothers, but more like cousins. But in other words, the in-laws, they didn't care for Jesus. You know, he was a sin child. And, you know, I mean, so there's a lot of that stuff that we don't quite catch in our modern study of these texts. But they're there. If they're there for they're hiding in plain sight. It's just that we don't always interpret them. Ah, Joseph, because he was a just man, decided not to have her stoned, but he would just quietly divorce her. Well, that's not what that text means at all. I mean, Joseph was going to follow the law.
Yes.
And until God intervened through the angel and said, Joseph, he was going to do what the law required. And when he didn't, I promise you that there was a lot of social consequences for what he did in taking that woman into his house. And it either meant that he was guilty of fornication, some people probably thought, or that Mary was in fact pregnant by another man. But again, what kind of a woman are you bringing into our family? So anyway, so a different world, huh? All right. Now, this is one of my favorite lines from in Fools Never Learn, from verse 7. I just love this line from Sirach 22, verse 7.
Teaching a fool is like gluing a broken pot, or like disturbing a man in the depths of his sleep. He talks with the slumber who talks with a fool, for when it is over, he will say, "What was that?" Speak but seldom with the stupid man. Be not the companion of a brute. Turn away from him, and you will find rest and not be wearied by the lack of sense.
Again, it's kind of edgy, isn't it? And again, we have to be careful here, because not everybody that we would want to call a fool is necessarily really a fool. They may not just simply be as erudite in some areas we are. So let's be careful here. But again, let's try to remember what is really meant by a fool is someone who refuses to engage in anything transcendent. All they care about is material things like food and sex and pleasure and profit. And you ever see Star Trek, The Next Generation, or Deep Space Nine? Any of you who have followed these, there's this group called the Ferengi, and all they care about is profit. And if they can't make profit, there's just no point in it. and it's to the extreme. I mean, they won't do anything unless some guy is taking a drink from the bar, and someone runs into him, knocks the whole drink over, and the Ferengi brings him another drink. And says that'll be ten, whatever. Yeah, I mean, you know, just if it's not profiting, but if there's no profit in it, if there's nothing to be gained in terms of worldly benefits, if there's nothing pleasurable, or you know, if you can't eat it, or you know, whatever, then it's just we have to be careful when we talk about the fool. That's specifically what is meant by the fool, not just someone who's just a little less intelligent, you know, and maybe through no fault of their own. You know, don't talk to me about trigonometry. I'm going to be like, I mean, I'm lost in the first two moves. Well, you just do the factorial of this, and you turn the number over, and I'm lost. I don't think it's because I'm a stupid man. I'm just not particularly gifted at math, you know. But I'm not a fool anyway. But teaching a fool is like gluing a broken pot. I mean, it's still going to leak. You know, there's no use for a glued pot. Or like disturbing, this is my favorite part, disturbing a man in the depths of sleep. He talks with a slumberer who talks with a fool. For when it is over, he'll say, "What was that?" I'm waking from sleep. Oh, gosh. It's just terrible. It's terrible. Why? Because it's too rarefied. It's not, they can't profit from it, or can't have sex with it, pardon the expression, or they can't eat, it's not edible, or whatever. You know, it's not base enough for them. Okay. Now, what was that? Speak but seldom with a stupid man. Be not the companion of a brute. You know, turn away from him, you'll find rest, and not be wearied by his lack of sense. You know, there are just some people, we all know them, they just plain lack sense. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's something stupid and foolish, they're going to do it, and they're going to do it again and again, and they'll never learn. And it's just, don't waste all your time running after people and trying to set them straight. At some point, you have to say, well, you know, I think we have something of this concept in terms of dealing with addiction. I mean, you know, you just have to just let a person hit bottom. At some point, you have to sort of step back and say, I'm going to just let them take their course at this point. I'm not going to try to intervene or save. And I'm not trying to say people who are addicts are fools. I'm just saying that by analogy here, as we would sometimes do in the case of addiction, sometimes we have to just finally come to the point when someone is just going to live a disorderly life, and there isn't much time to waste spending trying to get them to stop, because they're just going to do foolish, stupid, and brutish things. Okay? They just plain lack sense. All right. Now, we can say a little bit here about swearing, and I want you to be careful about what's meant by the word swearing. We're going to have to study that a little. A little bit about language here, though.
Let not your mouth form the habit of swearing or becoming too familiar with the holy name. Just as a slave that is constantly under scrutiny will not be without wealth, so one who swears continually by the holy name will not remain free from sin. Let not your mouth become used to coarse talk, for in it lies sinful matter. A man who has the habit of abusive language will never mature in character as long as he lives.
Now, we tend to use the word swearing very broadly today, and we don't always use it correctly. When I was growing up, anyway, and maybe you all had the same, you know, in your own growing up years, when we were told not to swear, we included in that notion using cuss words. Mm-hmm. And, oh, you're swearing! But to swear in the scriptures means you're making an oath. Okay? And so swearing in scripture doesn't mean the same thing as we tend to use that word today. But in the scriptures, when you would swear, and Jesus tries to put an end to this notion, but you would raise your hand and you would basically say, I swear to God. Okay? And we have some of that, you know, when we take an oath in the testifying, you know, so help me God, or something to that effect. I remember as a kid sometimes, you know, getting into this, I swear to God! And they actually had lots of different ways of swearing to God. You would sometimes swear by the holy name. I swear by the name of God, or I swear by the gold in the temple, or I swear by the gifts in the temple. There were different levels and all kinds of legalistic things about different oath formulas and different swearing formulas. And the Lord Jesus just finds this tedious, and he says, don't even swear at all. Mm-hmm. Don't swear by your head. You can't make a hair whiter or gray. I mean, you can't. Don't swear. But don't swear by the gold or the temple. Don't swear. Don't swear at all. You just be a man or woman of truth. All right. Now, but swearing doesn't just mean using foul language. Now, that is mentioned in this text, but not under the heading swearing. But it refers to that as coarse language, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But what it's really saying here is, first of all, don't form the habit of swearing or becoming too familiar with the holy name. Now, in this case, it doesn't mean R-G-D, you know, or J-C. I mean, that's not what the kind of swearing that's meant here. But rather, you know, I swear by the name of Jesus Christ. You know, don't get into the habit of doing things like that. In the Old Testament, it was very common, and people swore by these things all the time. But why is it a problem? It says here, just as a slave is constantly under scrutiny will not be without wealth, so will the one who swears continually by the holy name not remain free from sin. Now, why does a person need to swear so much? Well, Jesus gives the other end of the spectrum. He says, why should you have to swear at all? Why is your why doesn't your yes always mean yes and your no mean no? Why is it that you're so untrustworthy that you have to square about everything? Shouldn't you just be a man or woman of your word? And when you say yes, you mean it, and people know you mean it. And when you say no, you mean no, and people know you mean it. So, in effect, what the Lord is, what the text here is saying is that, why are you under such scrutiny all the time? What is there about you that's so untrustworthy? And be careful, because eventually, when you swear by the name, you are going to not come through. You are going to be lying, and then you're in serious trouble. You're in serious sin, because God will not leave unpunished those who swear by His name falsely. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. It really meant in the Old Testament, you shall not swear falsely using the name of God. Okay? It didn't mean just, you know, using God's name in, you know, it's an expression of negativity. It would include that eventually, but fundamentally its first meaning meant you shall never raise your hand and swear by the scriptures, with your hand on the scriptures, or you shall never swear by God's name falsely, ever. God's name is holy. Don't you ever do that. And God will not leave unpunished those who swear by His name falsely. So, in other words, that's what this text is warning us. Now, as far as some of the other stuff that we euphemistically call swearing, I don't need to give examples, I hope, but you know, these cuss words that we use, which aren't the divine name, and they're not oath formulas, but they're just words that we use which are ugly, the so-called four-letter words. That's what I think is meant here by coarse language. All right, it says here, someone who swears, verse 13. Let not your mouth be used to coarse talk, for in it lies sinful matter. Okay, so it's sinful. It's sinful to speak in this matter, or in this manner. All right. I was accustomed to this at a time in my life when I was younger, in high school and early college, to use a lot of foul language. I thought it made me sound mature. I thought it made me sound impressive. I was pretty impressed with myself as I blank this and blank that and blank, blank, blank. And, you know, some of the drinking buddies would, yeah, that's right, man. But as I became a little bit older, you know, God kind of gave me a different way of seeing it, and I began to. But you have a bad habit after a while. You just kind of get in a bad habit of using these expressions. So I began to say, well, every time I say these one of these words, I will then out loud also say a word of praise to God. So, and little by little, they went away. So when people come to me and they say, well, they're struggling with bad language or whatever, I usually give that kind of as a bit of advice. I say, well, get in the habit of every time you do this, you know, blank this, you say, I should say praise the Lord, you know, or something, you know, something of praise, you know, would be, so you make reparation. So, and little by little, it's gone away. I almost never, I mean, occasionally, I'm like anybody, you know, you bang your thumb and like, almost never now, almost never. I'm not trying to boast, I'm just saying I thank God who's delivered me from stupid and foolish behavior.
Question about this, so when I look at the Price is Right at work, there was a lady that kept saying, oh my God, you know,
yeah,
I can't
yeah.
say it.
No, I agree with you. That's a vain, it's a vain use. Now, vain, the word vain means empty.
Right.
And empty uses of God's name, oh my God, you know,
right.
Is just an empty expression, which means nothing. It's not praise, it's just exasperation or even joy, but it's not really holy. And, you know, I agree. I try to avoid, and every now and then I catch especially young people, and I start to say to them, you know, think about that now. Mm-hmm. That's not an appropriate way to speak God's name, as a throwaway expression.
Okay.
It's not that at all. I agree. Thank you. All right. Now, so be careful about the coarse talk, for in it lies sinful matter. And a man who has the habit of using abusive language. Now, in this case, abusive here doesn't just mean you're using bad words, but you're abusing someone. Blank you! You know, that's... It may not even be it with a four-letter word, you know. It could be some other, you know, expression that it may not technically be a curse. By the way, we also have this expression, curse words. And again, you got to be careful here because curse words, well, curse words would be, you know, if I were to say, God damn you, you know, that's, I'm cursing you. I mean, I'm hoping you go to hell. I'm cursing you to hell. You see what I'm saying? Or damn you. That's what we mean by curse words. So we tend to use these expressions, swear words, curse words, and cuss words, as meaning all the same thing, but they're actually they're all distinct. Curse words would include the word damn in them. Swearing words would be where we, when we use God's name, you know, to swear inappropriately. And then what we might call cuss words would be four-letter words, okay? So just to make all these distinctions. But again, there's a lot of, you know, we're talking about abusive language where we use language and we direct it at people in abusive ways or speak about people in abusive ways. It simply says here that whoever has the habit of abusive language will never mature in character as long as he lives. All right. Why? Well, because this bespeaks of itself immaturity to speak in this manner, to be full of cursing and abusive words and so on, just simply bespeaks. It comes from an immature mentality. Now, I know that many of us who go on to mature in many areas of our life still struggle with some of these things. It doesn't mean we're completely intrinsically immature, but this is a sign of some immaturity, all right, to speak in these ways. And to begin to get control over our anger, to speak appropriately, to think before we speak, to be careful about how we speak, to be respectful, and not unnecessarily argumentative, this is a sign of maturity. This is a sign of holiness. But this running off at the mouth without any thinking and without any discernment of, as to whether this is helpful or holy or in any way, that is simply not a mature, in the Christian sense, way of living. Okay? Now, granted, James says, whoever can control the tongue is holy indeed, and it's one of the hardest members of the body to control. Okay, but in the end, this is what is meant by maturity, to be able to start to be able to do this. All right, going on about God seeing all. This is a concept that's forgotten today. I think is that God is watching. You know, I told you before. Sometimes I go up to young people who are joning on each other, goofing off, or hitting each other, or lying about something. And I'll say to them, I'll say, God is watching. And they kind of look at me like, they kind of get what I'm saying, but it hadn't occurred to them. That's not really on their radar. And this is very increasingly, we live in an increasingly secular culture. And so what this text is about to remind us is that God sees everything.
And the man who dishonors his marriage bed and says to himself, who can see me? Darkness surrounds me. Walls hide me. No one sees me. Why should I fear to sin? Of the Most High, he is not mindful, fearing only the eyes of men. He does not understand that the eyes of the Lord, 10,000 times brighter than the sun, observe every step a man takes and peer into hidden corners. He who knows all things before they exist still knows them all after they are made. Thus all who dwell on the earth shall know, and all who inhabit the world shall understand, that nothing is better than the fear of the Lord, nothing more salutary than to obey his commandments.
Okay. And in this case, the fear of the Lord simply means to have a very sober and respectful knowledge that whatever I do, whatever I think, God sees, God knows. There is nothing hidden from God. Nothing. So you might get away with it in human eyes, but you will not. You will not. Now, unfortunately today, even people who admit God sees everything sort of fabricate a false God who doesn't really care if I do this. God doesn't really care if I go to church or not. God doesn't care if I sleep with my girlfriend or not. You know. And so they make up a false God. They may admit that God sees, but their God doesn't mind. Or their God understands. He understands why I'm doing what I'm doing. You know. So, and I don't know if you've noticed what I've been describing to you is idolatry. To make up, or fashion your own God and worship that God is idolatry. So the only surefire way of worshiping the one true God is to get to know the God of Scripture. who, as he reveals himself, not just the God as you want him to be, but the real, the true God as he actually is, as he himself has revealed himself, this is the God you got to get to know and worship, not a made-up God who, quote, doesn't care if I do this or don't do that. Okay, so be careful. So even those who do admit that God sees everything sometimes fall into another form of this sin, which is they've got a false God that they're thinking about. Okay, so God sees it all. All right. Now, best thing, repent. If you fall through weakness, repent. All right. This has in mind here sexual sin. It could be any sin, but do not call good what God does not call good. I would say that, all right? All right. I think God is merciful and understanding of our weaknesses, but in the end, do not call good what God calls evil. Okay? Don't do that. God sees all through the machinations of your mind and how you're playing little games with yourself and you're engaged in idolatry. Okay. Let's go on. We're getting to some dangerous territory here. The good wife and the bad wife. Now remember, this book was written by men. For men.
Happy the husband of a good wife. Twice lengthened are his days. A worthy wife brings joy to her husband. Peaceful and full is his life. A good wife is a generous gift bestowed upon him who fears the Lord. Be he rich or poor, his heart is content, and his smile is ever on his face. A gracious wife delights her husband. Her thoughtfulness puts flesh on his bones. A gift from the Lord is her governed speech, and her firm virtue is of surpassing worth. Choicest of blessings is a modest wife, priceless her chaste person. Like the sun rising in the Lord's heavens, the beauty of a virtuous wife is the radiance of her home. Like the light which shines above the holy lampstand are her beauty of face and graceful figure. Golden columns on silver bases are her shapely limbs and steady feet.
So it's very nice and all. I think some modern feminists would object to some of the qualities being highlighted and some of the qualities not mentioned. But basically what we have here is I think, a very good description of that a man really ought to give thanks for a good wife.
Right.
It's so easy for us to count things that are less appealing. We can easily focus on some little fault or some minor thing. But really, husbands, give thanks for a good wife. Twice lengthened are his days. You know, he brings this wife brings joy to her husband. Peaceful and full is his life, and so on. A smile is ever on his face, right? Now, it says here, a gracious wife delights her husband, and her thoughtfulness puts flesh on his bones. Now, this again is a cultural thing that we should maybe just spend a minute on, just because we're in a very different world today. But the idea of putting flesh on his bones is that he gains weight. Now, in the ancient world, up until really only about 100 years ago, the idea of being plump was considered actually a good thing. Because usually meant that you were well-to-do. It was a sign of wealth. You had more than enough food. And your large belly sort of manifested this fact. And generally speaking, women who were a little more plump than they are today, shall we say, and you ever remember some of those Gibson Girl commercials from the? I mean, you know, I don't think you remember them, but I mean, you may have seen reprints of them from the '20s, and these were, shall we say, heftier women than usual today. And have you seen Renaissance art of women? Mm-hmm. You know, rather plump these women are. This was considered beauty because it was a sign of care. It was a sign of being either wealthy or well cared for. It was a sign of fertility. Women who were a little heavier tended to be more fertile, the general idea here was that a woman showed love to her husband by fattening him up a little bit. Now, it's true, I'm sure, in those days, as it was in these days, that younger men tend to be thin, and older men tend to be more plump. It's just the way we are. I mean, but the idea is that part of their experience of that was that a good wife cooked some good dinners for her husband, and she fattened him up a little bit. And but this was all considered good. Now we've become very extreme in the other direction. I think oh my God, we've all got to weigh what we did in high school. Well, that's not A, it's not realistic, but B, even if you do weigh what you did in high school, it doesn't look the same. Amen. I mean, it's head up the same way. But it's a very almost obsession that we have with being thin. Now, I don't mean to say that we should be unhealthily fat, but I'm just saying that, just so you know, there's been a lot of cultural shifting, even in just the last 100 years, about this kind of thinking. Just so you know. This text, when it says her thoughtfulness puts flesh on his bones, doesn't mean she's giving him high blood pressure and cholesterol. It means it was actually considered a good thing. Now, I would say that most of the people who were plump in those days were probably not nearly as plump as some of us in the modern world can become. I think that we're dealing with a lot of processed foods and things that are playing with our metabolism. But they, if you look at some of the pictures, even of 150, 200 years ago, there were some pretty hefty bellies manifest there. Some of the men and the women weren't exactly rail thin. You know, I'm sorry, I turned this phone. So, again, not like we have today. We definitely do have issues today with obesity. So I don't want to just sniff at our concerns about weight. There are definite health concerns, and we live longer too. Carrying a lot of weight for many years can really, tear on the body. All right. It goes on here to become almost a little say, baby. Talking about the shape of her body a little bit there. This was very uncommon, but I want you to know that the biblical text, if you ever read the Song of Songs, and these people were not out of touch with sexual, allurement and pleasure. I mean, obviously, the human race continued through these years, so it's not like, oh, the Bible would never mention the shape of a woman's body, or read the Song of Songs, and there's lots of this stuff in the Bible. It's all done, though, I think, very poetically and beautifully. It's not pornographic, and of course, as you see here, this is not in any way on Shay's speaking. But it simply says that, first of all, it praises her for her modesty and her chastity. I'll be honest with you. Most men I know really do want their wives to dress modestly. But there's a few men I've encountered, some of my high school buddies, they kind of want their wife to sort of dress provocative. And I asked one guy, I said, aren't you kind of worried that your wife dresses like this? I want everybody to see what I'm getting.
All right.
But in the ancient world, I said, well, we're all seeing it, that's for sure. But I'm surprised by that attitude. It really surprises me a lot. But the idea is that, generally speaking, especially here in biblical times, the ideal was that a woman dressed modestly, and that with her husband, she, obviously was intimate, but this was something that was kept hidden, from others. Now, the word modesty, if you really look up its root meaning, it means reverence for mystery. Mm-hmm. Really, that's what modesty means, modestia. And I don't have time to go to all the roots, but basically it means a reverence for mystery. And there are just some things which are meant to be mysterious. Mm-hmm. And clearly, I was going to say mystery. Yeah. But I think that without getting into long discussions, standards of modesty will change in different cultures and things. So I don't mean to say that there's only one standard for modesty. I think that even in our own culture, we have one standard of modesty down at the beach and another thing in the corporate boardroom. For a woman to walk into a corporate boardroom in a bikini, or a man not to wear a shirt in a corporate boardroom, would be, what are you doing? My God. Whereas at the beach, this is, acceptable. But so even in our culture, there's a little give and take about this stuff. But generally speaking, one ought to reverence the mystery of oneself and only reveal it to those to whom it's appropriate. That's the vision of modesty. It's really what it's about. So this is not some prudish biblical hatred of sex. It's just the opposite. It's that a man and his wife are to be intimate. But this is a very precious mystery that only they have together. And otherwise, it's kept covered. So, by the way, there's an interesting thing liturgically that we do. I don't know if you've noticed it. In this parish, we do it. In most parishes, I've noticed they don't use it anymore. But have you ever noticed that we cover the chalice with a veil until it's brought out for use? The reason for that is, again, the chalice is a very precious and special cup. It's not just any ordinary cup, and so we call it a chalice, not just a cup. But since it's meant for a very sacred and specific use, it's kept covered until that moment that it's to be used. And this is kind of, again, the appreciation of sexuality, which is that these aspects of our body are very precious, very special, and they have a very specific use, and they're only uncovered for that use. Otherwise, they're kept covered out of reverence for the beauty. So we don't cover that chalice because it's ugly and we don't want to see it as bad, but it's just the opposite. It's beautiful, but it's meant for a very specific thing, only to hold the blood of Christ on the altar, and so we only take it out for that very special moment and uncover it at that time. Otherwise, it's covered. Just to connect some other dots for you on this question of modesty. The book of Revelation is sometimes called the book of Apocalypse, the Apocalypse. Now, the Greek word apokalypsis means, well, I won't write it up there right now, but when we get the word apocalypse, it means unveiling, the unveiling. And what it really means in that context is, remember how it says, keep hidden, keep secret or hidden the words of these books until, and so on. And then, you know, at the proper time is to be revealed. Well, so there's an unveiling, if you will, in the book of the Apocalypse of what is to come, an unveiling. And in the Jewish, most of the Jews at the time of Jesus actually spoke Greek. Not Hebrew. They did use that in the temple, but most of them spoke Greek. And they used this word apokalypsis for the wedding ceremony. In the Jewish wedding ceremony, it would be about a 5-day event. Long things, these Jewish weddings. And they would be done in the times of the month when the seed was in the ground and you were just kind of waiting for things to happen. So they had time on their hands. And they would have these 5-6-day weddings. And on the first day of the wedding, you know, the groom would arrive and so on. But at a certain point, at the end of the first day, the bride and the groom would be taken to a private area for the apocalypse. The bride and the groom would be shown to their private room or tent, depending on what, and they were alone for the first time, and the veil was removed, and I suppose a little more than the veil. and there was, if you will, the first intimacy, and this was called the apocalypse. The apokalypsis in Greek. So it's an interesting thing. And isn't it interesting that the Greek title for the book of Revelation is the Apocalypse? And what is the fundamental image of at the end of the Apocalypse? The Lamb with his bride. Mm-hmm. See? And what happens? The bride comes forth, beautiful as a bride, adorned for her husband. And then what happens? Well, Jesus is joined to his bride, and Satan is thrown into hell, and the bride is with Christ forever. And that's the marital. So just so you connect some of the dots. I don't mean to bore you with lots of these details, but you see there's a lot of dots to connect here in this idea simply of modesty, of reverence for mystery, that things are kept veiled except for the special moments they're meant for, and that's the whole idea of modesty. All right, to openly display things, you know, in this way is just completely inappropriate. All right, now, okay, so we've looked at the good wife, look out for the bad wife. But again, notice again, it mentions regarding this good wife, again, the beauty of her face, her graceful figure, golden columns are her shapely limbs, you know. And it was rare, by the way, for anyone to see leg anywhere in the Holy Land, even to this day.
Yeah.
Do you know that in most parts of the Holy Land, you're not even allowed to wear shorts, even if you're a man?
Mm-hmm.
You're not allowed. It's just simply not. But the idea of, you know, this obviously this understanding of seeing her legs and so on, this is only between a man and his wife in that culture. We you know, we never see a woman's legs in that culture at that time, and even to this very day in most parts of the Muslim world. You don't see a woman's legs. Okay. All right. So, a bad wife. Go ahead and read that.
A bad wife is a shaking yoke. He who marries her seizes a scorpion. A drunken wife arouses great anger, for she does not hide her shame. By her eyelids and her haughty stare, an unchaste wife can be recognized. Keep a strict watch over an unruly wife, lest finding an opportunity, she makes use of it. Follow close if her eyes are bold, and be not surprised if she betrays you. As a thirsty traveler with eager mouth drinks from any water that he finds, so she settles down before every tent peg and opens her quiver for every arrow.
Okay. So as you can see, there's a little bit of, more than vivid imagery there at the end.
Yes.
But again, we have here, though, I think, though, something that puts a little bit of the lie to the fact that women were just basically left in kind of a prison situation, and they had no social mobility. They could do almost nothing in the ancient world. Now, granted, they don't have the kind of mobility they have today. I agree. But I just want you to see that, obviously, women had some opportunities that we don't. We just can't see that they were locked in their homes and could never come out. You understand that, right? So, and again, I want to just say this, because remember, this is written by men for men. We all know, though, but all of us in this room are aware, if not in your own marriage, I hope, but you know, maybe in your own marriage, but if not your own marriage, someone else's marriage, that you know that some of the most painful and awful things can be bad marriages. It's just horrifying, some of the stuff that can go on in really bad situations. Some of the greatest grief, it says here, a chafing yoke. You know what a yoke is? Think of two oxen pulling a wagon. You don't just put a rope around their neck, do you? What you have to do is you have to put a wood truss across the whole frame of their chest, and that way their whole body pulls forth. Well, a chafing yoke, you see, they would be very careful to cut it just to the shape of the animal so it fit perfectly across the chest of the animal with every little curve, and they work very carefully to make these yokes. But what happens is that if the animal, if the yoke wasn't perfectly fitting, it would cause a blister. Basically, the fur would rub off, and there would be a, you know, chafe or irritation. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, the interesting thing about that, like chafing yoke, is that it could be the smallest little shape. It's very painful. Like for long distance running, and so they, you know, you put glide everywhere. Because it's the simplest shape.
Yeah.
It's like it totally disrupts your running.
That's right. You're right. Mm-hmm. We all know what a blister's like. It's very painful, and man, it's like. So in the end, we have here this idea that, you know, a chafing yoke, that, oh my gosh, you're just trying to get through life, and you've got this just grievous wound. And every time you try to move forward, it just makes it worse. You see, that's the image here of a bad marriage. All right. So, what is the advice? Well, again, it's not written here, but elsewhere. You know, look, be careful who you marry. Now, of course, in that culture, they couldn't really have a lot of choice. But, you know, just, you know, we who do, careful who you marry. You know, just because they're good-looking, that doesn't mean much.
That's right.
It's nice to have a good-looking spouse, but, you know, there's got to be some looks involved. But don't be careful here. Be careful. See who you marry. Make sure that they share some of your values. Try not to marry someone with a bad temper. Try to be careful. At least know what you're getting into, you know, and every now and then, I know someone, you know, some people who marry people who do have anger issues and all, but I often say, well, I want you to remember this when it comes up. See, you bought into this now. You know what they're like. Yeah.
So you can't just marry someone because they look good. Or somebody that you have some things in common.
Yeah. The only problem with being too particular today is that when our society is breaking down to the extent that it is, it's pretty hard to find somebody who doesn't have issues. We're coming from increasingly, you know, unhealthy families, and you know, people got stuff going on, and they've had stuff going on, and you know, it's kind of hard to find the girl next door, so to speak, or the guy next door. It's going to be a little. What's that?
It's just
But you know, anyway, so I think we have to be a little, you know, what I'm saying, we just have to sort of accept that we're in a situation now where increasingly many of our young people are raised in less than ideal situations, and they're not always as prepared for marriage, and so on. And
I
so
still think they need to have some things in common. Some things
I agree. Yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm. I think it's, I've come to a conclusion it's really important to belong to the same church.
Mm-hmm. I do too.
Or to the same faith.
Same faith, right. I agree. A lot of things are important.
And you're going to church over here. That means whether you go to church on Saturdays or Sundays, that weekend is gone.
Yeah.
He's at church on Saturday, he's at church on Sunday, you don't get
killed. And some people, you know, they pull it off. Some people do, but I'm just saying we have to. I'm just saying we have to balance all these things and just be careful.
Right.
Just be careful about knowing what you're getting into. That this is going to be an issue, and just knowing it ahead of time and being sober about it, and not saying, "Well, 5 years into, well, I didn't know it was going to be this bad." You know. So at least be careful who you marry. And if you're going to marry someone, they're always going to be imperfect. So you got to know ahead of time and just say, "Is this? Am I able to accept this and live with
it?" Then you got these families that don't like the man.
Right.
Or you got these families. We've already went through this in my family. The problem with my oldest brother. His wife had a problem with the mother-in-law blues. He had that mother-in-law blues.
Yeah.
And my brother, as old as he was,
yeah, it's not just
when he would get home, he would call and say, "Well, Mom, I'm home." You could hear her in the background, "Cousin, why you gotta call and tell your so-and-so mother that you home and you 25 years old or you 30 years old?"
Mm-hmm.
My sister said you can hear that in the background.
Well, sometimes it isn't just a couple. You're right. There's some nuts falling out of the whole family tree. And speaking of this, this therefore brings us back to a very critical issue, which we'll end with tonight, about raising children well. Okay? Could you just read the last paragraph there? The very last one there, yeah. That one, yeah. We'll just skip a couple here.
"He who loves his son chastises him often, that he may be his joy when he grows up. He who disciplines his son will benefit from him and boast of him among his intimates. He who educates his son makes his enemy jealous and shows his delight in him amongst his friends. He who spoils his son will have wounds to bandage and will quake inwardly at every outcry. A colt untamed turns out stubborn. A son left to himself grows up unruly. Pamper your child and he will be a terror for you. And indulge him and he will bring you grief. Share not in his frivolity, lest you share in his sorrow. When finally your teeth are clenched in remorse, give him not his own way in his youth and close not your eyes to his follies. Bend him to the yoke when he is young, thrash his sides while he is still small, lest he become stubborn, disobey you, and leave you disconsolate. Discipline your son, make heavy his yoke, lest his folly humiliate you."
Well, again, completely, you know, someone might say, "Well, what about the corporal punishment stuff and all?" Well, look, I mean, you know, we can get into endless debates about that, so let's leave that aside and just say, well, I mean, we're not talking about utter beatings, but you know, an occasional slap or on the hand or swat on the butt can be well placed, according to me. But not everybody agrees with that. But setting that aside, pamper your child, and he will become a terror for you. Indulge him, and he will bring you grief. And then it says something which I think is so important today, because I've seen this violated increasingly by parents. "Do not share in his frivolity, lest you share in his sorrow." I've seen parents act like goofy teenagers around their teenagers and give their kids stuff at parties to drink.
Yeah. Yes.
"I want to be popular with my kids' friends." Don't share in frivolity. Youth are going to do stupid things, but don't share in it and don't facilitate it. And I've heard some parents say, "Well, they're going to fornicate somewhere, so I might as well give them the bedroom to fornicate in." I'm like,
"Oh,
you know." I mean, the thinking is just completely foreign to me, and yet I'm finding more of it. And what I just plain stinking thinking, you know. And again, set a very clear standard. Now, I think, you know, my own father, I don't think did any of this perfectly, but he did it, and I'm grateful to him these many years later. I generally am fairly, I'm a fairly well-disciplined individual. I know how to work hard. I don't complain about hard work, and I credit my father, you know, for a lot of that. My father just did not tolerate, and I'm generally respectful of authority. I get along well with my bishops, and even if I don't completely agree with some particular point here or there, I'm able to do what I need to do, to be respectful. I thank my father for all those things, and my father was always absolutely clear with us that we were never to disrespect his authority. And he had his own struggles, he had his issues, he was not a perfect man. Isn't that an important lesson? You don't respect people because they're perfect. That's not the standard. When I was a child, I was expected to obey my elders, unless they asked me to do something that was obviously evil. So again, I can just simply say that I think this little paragraph here would maybe need to be, I'm going to be using this paragraph, I'm going to be dealing with some of our youth leaders. Here in the next couple of weeks, we're going to be looking at some of the evangelical stuff we need to start doing for our young people. But this is a pretty good little teaching paragraph to use. But again, failing to correct, being a pushover, not correcting, not punishing when necessary. This is not good.
Father,
this leads to a real problem.
I'm sorry, number 13, discipline your son, make heavy his yoke, lest his folly humiliate you.
Yeah. Well, it is a little hard to understand that it's not sounding excessive, isn't it?
Right.
But I think that, well, let me just give you an example from my own youth to see if maybe this would. My father, when we were young, insisted that we lift weights and do regular exercises. He also insisted that we run a mile a day. Occasionally we would sort of try to get out of it. But he was generally pretty good at checking up on us. And I will say this, I have put on weight over the last number of years, but I've always been very healthy. Blood pressure's been good, cholesterol, even to this day where I'm a little overweight. I don't have any of those problems. I exercise almost every day. I take a walk every day. I'm very, very disciplined about those things. And in that sense, when most of my friends were goofing off or whatever, my father insisted that I was going to do exercise. And so in a way, he made heavy my yoke. Not in an irrational way, but he added a little bit of extra weight for me to carry so that I got used to carrying the much heavier weights that would come when I was an adult, namely, I don't mean this weight, but I mean the weight of life. And if you kind of grow up being protected and schmoozed and you don't learn that hard work is part of life, I don't know how, because we all know that whether you like it or not, hard work does come, it shows up. And if you're not used to carrying it, I don't see how you're going to be up for the task. And so I think that it means that. I don't think it means to just pile heavy yokes on them and just drive them to their, just falling asleep in bed. But I think it does sort of have that implication, at least, that the times you intentionally put extra weights on your kids so they can learn to carry it. Yeah.
I told somebody that the other day. The kids, they're not letting them do anything. And when they get away to college, they won't know how to keep themselves up. They won't know how to wash their clothes. They got a maid coming in.
Yeah, that's the other thing. My mother made sure we knew how to wash our clothes and cook dinners. And
they're twins.
And I like to kid that I can't cook because I'm not much of a good cook. But my mother did teach me to cook basic stuff. She said, Charlie, I'm not going to have you leaving my home not knowing the basics. So I know how to cook salad and. wash my clothes.
The same way because I always told them I taught them how to use the washing machine. Because there was no guarantee that you would get a wife.
Yeah. Or a wife that would sew. Yeah.
I raised my son to say, you will have to help take care of your wife. You're going to have to learn how to do all these things. So when they went away to college,
right,
they ended up going to a house. And said, oh, Mom, he said, let me go to a house. He said, I'll manage it. And I called up and talked to him, and one of his roommates answered the phone, and I asked for my son, and he said, "Mother, someone wants my son." I said, "You know, he calls you mother." He says, "Can you believe it?" He said, "They don't know how to pick up dirty towels
right, or
they don't know how to wash the dishes. They can't load the dishwasher. They don't even know what to do with their dirty clothes."
That's right.
He said, "Don't they have mothers?" But you see, that's I look on those things as the yoke is being expectation.
Mm-hmm.
What I see a lot of, what I hear on the street is, "You little shit, get up here." Those aren't expectations.
That's right.
Given that child, that child's not a blessing to you. Instead, you're giving this child the cursing and the swearing, which they don't need, and it's going to be a detriment to them.
Yeah.
So I look at this right here as being an expectation that you're putting on them in order to be a successful person later.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, some people overdo it, no doubt about it. Because after 37 years of teaching, I've seen both extremes. But I have found with parents who have expectations for their child, even on some that I feel have been a little bit off the wall, those kids will live up to those expectations.
Uh-huh.
And if those expectations is, "You're a little shit, and you're just stupid like your father,"
that's right.
That's exactly how they grow up.
I mean, that's those young men you saw on the street today, huh?
You know, what's funny is, they attacked this one fellow. But when, I guess they used my teacher voice 2 weeks ago, when I caught them behind one of the garages smoking pot, not going to school, I got after them.
Yeah.
And they left and didn't say anything to me. And I did have two dogs with me.
All right. We may amatanamayam.
Well, it's kind of like a drug dealer. I didn't know that's what he was. He was bullying his dog. And I stopped there and I said, I said, "Leave that dog alone, you big meanie." And he turned and looked at me because that's my dog. And I said, "Then you should know better. All that dog wants to do is please you. Look what you're doing to it." I said, "Put teasing that dog."
Right.
And so I said, "Come here." I said, "I'll take you somewhere you can give some lessons with it." So that man walks past my house and I give out little dog treats for his dog. And he says hi to me every time. When I taught these girls in school, and we do the sex ed thing, and I was supposed to teach them about abortion, but I refused to. And I was in a public school, and the little girl said to me, and these are fifth graders, said, "Well, what are we supposed to do?" And I said, "You say no. You say no to drugs. You say no to sex. You say no. It's your body."
Mm-hmm.
And the little girls came up to me and they said, "You know, no one's ever told us.
Oh, no.
No one's ever told us to do that before."
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that sad?
Really sad.
And that's what the problem is. That's the reason I look at this joke as being expectations.
Yeah.
And people aren't taking any time to talk to kids about what they expect. Or Dr. Dobson was focused on the family, went out there to visit. And my two sons didn't want to go for the visit because they were in high school. They took the high school students separately. They came back all smug. And I said, "What did you guys learn?" And they said, "Oh, we'll let you know later." I said, "Well, you don't seem to be hard-pressed about having to go on this tour." And they said, "Oh, no, we learned something."
Oh, good.
Well, a little bit later, I found out what it was.
Well,
they got in trouble for something. They said, "You know, Mom, God gave you to us as gifts from God. After God just wanted us to have you remember that."
I remembered one thing.
But, yeah, of adults in the parents' tour, they said, "Remember, when your child leaves that house, whether it's to go to school or they're going out that door, you stop, and if you're the father, you stop and you say to that child, 'You are a blessing to me, and you are a gift to me.' And when you leave and your mother should give you a hug and they send you out the door with the thought that you are a gift from God and that you accepted this gift as your responsibility and you love them."
There is the one line, final line to end with at the end of verse 11. "Close not your eyes to his follies."
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, just to get back to the school situation and try to conclude here. Frequently, when until recently, I've always had a Catholic school, and we have troubles disciplining some of the kids, and sometimes the main problem is the parents, because when we indicate to the parents, "Well, you know, your child has been misbehaving or whatever," he said, "Not my little angel." And we said, "Your little angel has a demon." And, but again, not wanting to see that again, we have to be partners in this disciplining of the children. And yeah, there are occasional times where there's something unfair that comes up. But, you know, frankly, my parents' attitude was, all right, you feel like you got falsely accused this time, but don't tell me you haven't not gotten caught a lot of times. You did do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, there wasn't a lot of discussion around this. Oh, well, Johnny did it. I didn't do it. Yeah, but you have done it, haven't you? Well,
right.
But anyway, the idea is don't close your eyes. You know, the fact of the matter is all of our children are born with original sin. And even after baptism, they like us, struggle. They have deep drives of sin. And we just have to get accustomed to the fact that our kids need, like any of us, to have very firm, clear boundaries and discipline. And without it, they will tend to grow increasingly unruly and incorrigible and very problematic. So that's, I think, the place to end. A lot of things to discuss there. We could continue, but it's late, so we'll end. Okay. In the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. Lord, we bless you and thank you for this wisdom, which is in these words, and we ask your blessing that we can try to apply them in our life. Again, I feel like we're with our little Dixie cup in front of a fire hydrant. A lot of the water that has gushed in our direction may perhaps has escaped us. But whatever does remain in our Dixie cup, Lord, let it take deep root in our life. And we ask that we can continue to come back to this great font of your word and more see its beauty and its wisdom through Christ our Lord. Amen.
Amen.
All right, thank you all. We'll meet...